This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and with me today is the historian Gary Cross, author of The Cute and the Cool. Now, you might assume, thanks to Disney and our child-centered culture, that America leads the world in cuteness. But Japan has us beat by a long shot. We tasked our own Sarah Lilly with finding out why the warm and fuzzies have come to dominate this ancient culture that we think of as so serious and ascetic.
I have a confession. I think Hello Kitty is kind of irresistible. Hello Kitty is a round white cat that stands on two legs and wears a dress. The Japanese company Sanrio created the character 31 years ago, and today she's more popular than ever, with children and adults alike. Hello Kitty is decidedly kawaii.
The Japanese word is translated as cute into English.
Ann Allison is a cultural anthropologist at Duke University. She studied many modern Japanese artifacts, like toys, so she knows a lot about kawaii.
It often takes the form of big objects that maybe don't have mouths, like Hello Kitty, or big heads on little bodies. And people talk about their relationships with cute.
Japanese artist Takashi Murakami has his own take. In a nutshell, he's sort of like Japan's Andy Warhol, with his affinity for brightly colored prints and pop culture themes.
The concept of kawaii has been around in Japan for going on 20 years. I'm not sure of what it connotes in English, but in Japanese it's cool.
Murakami is something of an expert on cool. He started out as a painter and sculptor, but he became truly famous after he inked a deal with the Louis Vuitton company to create print designs for their wildly publicized handbags. You know the white ones dappled with a colorful variation of Vuitton icons and winking eyes? Celebrities love them, and they've sold like hotcakes. So yeah, Murakami knows something about cute, especially in Japan, where it's all cuteness all the time.
Why did cuteness culture arise? I've been pondering this issue. When you consider that defeat in the war was the starting line for everything in Japan, it all becomes clear.
Wait, so we have Hello Kitty because we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima? I know that Murakami has an equally Warholian reputation for stirring things up and calmly stepping back. Last year, he curated a show at New York's Japan Society, and he named it Little Boy.
When I looked into the history of the A-bomb, I learned that the bombs were named Little Boy and Fat Man. I thought these were highly symbolic. I thought they exemplified current Japanese cuteness culture and otaku culture. That's how Japan is now. We're like children. We are completely oblivious to politics. We don't ponder the place of Japan in the world or our places in Japanese society. We think only about the cute, having fun, seeking what we like. That custom has been ingrained in Japanese.
He talks at great length about his beliefs about this, which are a little confusing. I mean, they seem a little contradictory. And he will say the little boy is supposed to be a play on the atomic bomb that was named Little Boy, and also the little boy that Japan has subsequently become. And that seems to be not necessarily a good thing, but not necessarily a bad thing. There's something disturbing about it.
He seems to be saying that, in fact, it was sort of the basis or one of those originary moments of turning Japan into effectively a humiliated but also therefore infantile society.
Thomas Loesser teaches Japanese studies at New York University.
At the same time, I think there is a real sense that a lot of this idea of almost infantilism, but certainly of childhood, is about innocence that can be played with.
Loesser mentions a 32-year-old artist in Tokyo named Chinatsu Ban. She makes large molded plastic sculptures of brightly colored elephants and baby elephants. They're all wearing underpants.
She's quite open about saying that for her this is a talisman of a kind of innocence that she's afraid she'll lose.
It melts one's resistance. So cute. At the Little Boy exhibition, before the kitty section, everyone had such a happy face saying, "Oh." It removes barriers. Oh, so cute. I want one. Even the New Yorker said this.
Whether in a museum or a department store, Kauai is even used to promote Japanese entities to the Japanese themselves. Many towns, villages, or corporate interests have their own invented mascots called Yurukyara. These brightly colored, cartoony figures have strange characteristics and come in a zillion different incarnations, none of which makes any zoological sense. You can't really interpret them. It would be like trying to explain Gumby to George Washington. The point is, Yurukyara have an important function today, as ambassadors.
Why would you have a character, a cute character, be a symbol of a town or a community? Well, there is something incredibly appealing about them. I mean, you can't really hug a town, but you can hug those.
Ann Allison says there's even a new word for the power that comes from this kind of attraction. It's called soft power. Unlike the more bullying forces of the military or politics, soft power is all about the carrot. It also makes a lot of sense in the context of modern-day Japan.
The culture of Kyoto implies a world which is already entirely and completely a consumer world.
The Japanese government very recently has become very aware that the exports of cultural products like manga and anime and cute character goods are becoming very globally marketable in a way that's historically unprecedented for Japanese culture. And I think there's a sense that there could be a national interest in being able to promote itself as the producer of cool goods. Cute is something that's not just out there, it's not just a product, it's something that you feel deeply invested in.
It would be unnatural not to be proud of peaceful, cute characters born out of this peaceful status. We're a 60-year experiment in apathy. These are the kinds of silly cultures that arise when we are oblivious and just think about enjoying ourselves every day.
Nice life if you can get it. And if you get it, more power to you. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lilly.
Manamana. Manamana. Manamana.
A retrospective of Takashi Murakami's work will be opening at the Brooklyn Museum of Art in New York City next month. For more information, visit studio360.org. Professor Gary Cross is my guest today. I found it interesting in that piece when Murakami says that kawaii, the Japanese cuteness, has in Japan become this very cool thing since in America, cool and cute are virtually opposite.
The Japanese have, in a lot of ways, kind of combined the cute and the cool in the way that that Disney perhaps didn't earlier on. But I also thought that idea that because the Japanese are no longer a kind of a dominating military force in the world, that they have kind of retreated to the cute is a very interesting thing, because in a lot of ways, that's what the cute did to children in America in the beginning of the 20th century and still does. Before that, toys were often about growing up. They would tell you when you got a doll, this is how you have to look when you're an adult, because the doll looked like an adult and you would dress it like an adult. And so the cute in children's lives is really a signal that this is a time when you're supposed to be apart from the world and not really thinking about either the future or the serious qualities of life.
Why do you think that this Japanese subculture, and more than a subculture at this point, appeals so much to Americans, especially young Americans and young American artists?
Well, it's in part because it's fresh and new, but it's also, it seems to me, it has a lot to do with the fact that these are a series of representations that are so malleable and so multi-sided. The fact that it is contradictory is in many ways a source of its appeal, that you can take a monster and make it cute, for example.
And what about you? If I went to your home right now, would I find cute artifacts?
You find, like in a lot of people's homes, you find a lot of pictures of the children when they were young.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think makes us, not just my family, but so many families distinct, say, as to, in comparison to 100 years ago, is that we put pictures of children up in our houses, not of ancestors, nor of adults, really. So we have a lot of those. I don't have the symbols of, you know, I have no Keen pictures, of course. I too was told by my mother, who was an artist, that they were very uncool. I've enjoyed Disney, I have to admit. My friends find this appalling. But there's something really very enjoyable and delightful about the wonder that we project onto children.
Well, another expression of that kind of contradiction I see in this object I'm holding in my hand right now, which the show at the Japan Society gave away. It's this little plastic doll of this schoolgirl in her schoolgirl pack and little short skirt, incredibly short skirt and big eyes. And there is, to me, something, as with much of this of Japanese manga and anime, something sexualized about these figures. What do you make of that?
Well, actually, the cute has always been just a tad bit sexual, particularly in girl form. One of the early cute dolls of the 20th century was called Flossie Flirt, that was sold by Sears for several years in the 20s. And the idea of the cute was to be coquettish, to be sexually alluring in a kind of an innocent way. Even Shirley Temple produced a series of movies called Baby Burlesques before she did the features that Paramount made so famous, where she played Marlena Dietrich, who in the early 30s was a very sexual person.
Well, I remember growing up in the 60s and seeing those old black and white Shirley Temple movies. And I think it was the first time I was actually aware of cuteness as a commodity.
On the good ship, lollipop, it's a sweet trip to a candy shop.
Now, that seems to me, with motion pictures in the 1930s, that this kind of mass-marketed idea of cuteness really reached a new level.
Yeah, Shirley Temple certainly popularizes the idea. But in a sense, Shirley Temple is really a sort of a live version of, well, the dolls that appeared maybe about 20 years earlier. They were a whole series of dolls that were designed for a little girl to play with and who often looked just like Shirley Temple, you know, the short, the dimples on the face and knees, and with whom you were supposed to fantasize a friendship and the like.
So there's a history of that. Well, I'm also reminded of Lewis Carroll, Reverend Dodgson's photographs of little Alice, who from our perspective in the 21st century looks like he posed her in suggestive poses. From what I know of that history, that's probably wrong. It was a fairly innocent relationship. Is that because, you know, in 18 whatever that was, that borderland between cute and sexy weren't quite so fraught?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the difference. Today, and in fact, even in Shirley Temple's time, Graham Greene, the famous novelist, wrote a review of one of Shirley Temple's movies that her mother had suppressed on the grounds that Greene suggested that Shirley Temple was being overly sexual. And this, of course, Gertrude Temple couldn't tolerate. But there was something slightly sexual about her. And of course, it's become more so as time goes on with the baby beauty pageants, where that line between the cute and the sexual have really kind of broken down. We all remember
Jean-Benet Ramsey.
Yeah, a few years ago, which was really quite frightening in a lot of ways.
Well, it was. And I certainly had never – I was vaguely aware of that world but hadn't seen the films and videos of kids all made up in their, you know, kind of grown-up lady outfits. I found that very disturbing.
But you see, the cute is always ambivalent. It's about being dependent. It's about being adorable. But it's also about being perhaps just a tad bit desirous. And sort of that's one of the reasons why it seeps so much into advertising. On the one side, if you can make something cute, people want to buy it. But also, if you respond to the child's cuteness, you will respond to the child's desires as well.
So in the cultural lineage, there's a line between a Shirley Temple depiction and, say, Lolita.
Yeah, there's a very close connection between the two, really.
Gary Cross is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we've been talking about a new vogue for cute in the culture.